It's Border Crossings with Larry London from VOA Music Mix.
Hey, this is Larry London. We welcome you to another Border Crossings program. Today, a very special show just for you. We have not one, but two music icons. Back to the 70s and 80s we go for the next hour. Rick Springfield is here and Paul Rogers is here, and we're glad you're here. Welcome to Border Crossings. Hi, I'm Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings. Today, a very special guest in our studio, a multi-platinum superstar who's known around the world. We welcome Rick Springfield to The Voice of America in D.C. Welcome.
Hey, how are you?
Congratulations on all your success. I know this is an exciting time for you. You've got a new book coming out this week. Mm-hmm. And first of all, what brings you to D.C.? I know there's some special things going on that you're here for.
Yeah, we're going to the White House Correspondents' Dinner.
Yeah. Now, yes. you're gonna wine and dine with President Obama.
I'm not sure. I'm not sure how close they'll let me get to any politicians.
Well, we welcome you here, and it's an honor to meet you. We all listened to your music for a number of years and watched you on television. And I was interested to read in your bio that it was actually music first in your life.
Yeah.
A lot of us believe that you were, because you're so handsome and talented, that you were pursuing acting as your first love, and you became famous as Noah Drake on General Hospital.
Yeah, no, it started out as a guitar player when I was, started out learning guitar at 12. And I was in bands in Australia, grew up in Australia, and was in bands there, and then went solo and came over here in 71, 72.
Now, you don't have the accent anymore.
Well, I do sometimes, mate. When I have a couple of beers, it comes right out. You know what I'm saying?
But you were telling me that you have lived in so many different places. You've moved around a bit.
Yeah, well, my dad was in the Army, in the Australian Army, and every 2 years we're at a new school, and we moved all around Australia, and then we moved to England, which was great. At the age I was at, I was like 10 years old, so I was got into guitars and music and everything over there. And then basically I joined bands and started traveling again, so I've never really stopped traveling. We ended up going to Vietnam in 68 too, and playing for the troops. So my history with the armed forces goes way back.
Yeah, obviously, it's in your family.
As far as, you know, the TV music career thing goes, I mean, you came here as a musician then, and how did you get into television?
Between record deals, as they say, and needing to make some money, I foolishly thought, oh, I'll become an actor and make some money while I'm waiting for a record deal, you know? Meanwhile, all the guys in the acting class were waiting tables until they became actors. So it was a degree of innocence and stupidity, I think, on my part. But I started working as an actor and then ended up getting General Hospital. I got that just after I'd finished an album that became Working Class Dog. We had Jesse's Girl on it, and, you know, I've done everything for you. And so it was kind of just serendipitous that it all came together at the one point.
Right. Did you find it hard for people at that time to take you seriously because you were an actor? Yeah. And then, you know, was it harder to get the music out there?
Yeah. I think they thought I was, you know, some actor that some guy had got to sing on key for 3.5 minutes for in one song. You know, that's kind of, I think, was people's general view of me for quite a while. Mm-hmm. But I figured, you know, if I just keep writing and keep playing and doing the stuff that I love to do, that the truth will come out.
Right, you know. Right. And it's clear that you love what you're doing because you're so good at it. And, you know, in this business, you have a favorite part? Is it the songwriting? Is it the performing
line? No, I actually love writing, period. You know, I mean, I've been doing a lot of prose now with I wrote my own autobiography, which...
Yeah, a couple years ago.
And then this is the first work of fiction, but I have ADD too, so I sometimes lose my way.
What are you talking about?
What? Who?
Oh, look, a chicken.
Rick Springfield's in our studio. He's referring to Magnificent Vibration, which is the brand new book, which is fiction, and we're going to get into that. First, if I could ask you to do a song for us.
Oh, I mean, sure. This is a song I used to do in Vietnam for the troops. By the shape I'm in, I can't sing, ain't pretty, and my legs are thin. Don't ask you what I think of you, I might not give the answer that you want me to. Understand, he said, stick by me and I'll be your guiding hand. Don't ask what I think of you, I might not give the answer that you want me to.
Down with Rick Springfield right here on The Voice of America. We got the guitar, we got the music, we also got the book, Magnificent Vibration. Let's talk about your book. Mm-hmm. This is, as you said, fiction, your first time at fiction. You're a best-selling author. You wrote a tremendously selling, successful book a few years ago. Why fiction?
Well, my publisher actually liked my writing voice, so she said after they published the autobiography, she said I should be writing fiction, as was her words. But I'd always thought of, I'd done that originally as a kid. I really started out as a writer. Mm-hmm. It was the only thing I ever got any good grades for in school was for my essays, you know, and the teachers always encourage what you're good at, so it was either that or drumming on the desk. So they thought the best bet would be to go to a writer because you don't want to be a drummer.
A desk drummer.
What's that?
A desk drummer.
right.
So the album, the book, Magnificent Vibration, is kind of, it's a very interesting story. It's a very interesting concept. Someone gets, and I don't know if it's you put yourself in the first tense, if it's you, or someone gets a phone number, the 800 telephone number, to talk to God. Mm-hmm. That's the whole idea behind the book.
Well, that's the intro. That's the, kind of the setup for it. It's really, it's what they call an extreme novel. It kind of goes way south of that once he starts talking to God. And of course, he doesn't believe he's talking to God when he first does. It's a guy named Horatio Cotton, and he's a 32-year-old divorced, gone through a horrible divorce, hates his job, thinks his life is over, and he steals a self-help book called Magnificent Vibration, Discover Your True Purpose. And on the inside cover is handwritten notes, is 1-800-CALL-GOD. So he does, and it's pretty much disbelief from the start, you know, which you But God doesn't really guide them. You discover God's philosophy, and it deals with some serious subject, but it's really dark humor. I mean, it's very
right.
There's a lot of kind of weird sex stuff in it and everything, but it basically has a soul, and the soul is, you know, that we're destroying the earth we're supposed to be the caretakers, and we're the worst caretakers that the earth could possibly pick. Mm-hmm. And the earth we're past the tipping point. Mm-hmm. And so something needs to happen. Mm-hmm. And that's a culmination of the story.
Mm. How much of Horatio is really you?
All the characters in the book, they all start from moment of truth with me. Mm-hmm. Because I think that's the only way I could make them feel truthful, I think, was that if they started from a point of truth. Mm-hmm. But then as the story evolves, they hopefully take on a life of their own. Mm-hmm. And that's when the surprises come. For me, too, as a writer, it was kind of fun to see where they would go.
Right, right. Well, it must be fun to sit and write a book, although it consumes a lot of time. But
I wrote it in 4 months, actually, and it was really great because we travel a lot when we tour, mm-hmm. and I'm always on the plane. I can write on the plane, and, you know,
right.
kind of a captive audience.
Well, I mean, you know, I read through most of the book and enjoyed what I was reading, and it does take you on some surprises, some turns and twists that you don't expect to go in,
yeah.
and you bring up some interesting situations as well and deal with some sensitive subjects. And one of those subjects I'd like to deal with in your life is an ongoing thing that you get asked about quite often is the depression that you've dealt with in the past, mm-hmm. in your life.
I'm becoming the depression poster child.
That's
which
it.
Is not a good thing, but yeah, I get it.
Well, it is if you're helping others.
I guess so, yeah.
And so, I mean, but everything's good now. And
it depresses me, though.
It depresses you to think about depression.
That I'm the depressive... poster child, yeah, kind of counterproductive, but I've had to deal with it all my life, and I've always channeled. That's where my writing comes from, mm-hmm. is from that dark side, because I'm always. I don't know any writer that's well adjusted or is a shiny happy guy. There's no such thing as far as I'm concerned with, because all the creativity comes from
right.
you being introspective and looking in yourself, mm-hmm. finding out, trying to figure out what's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
That's the yin-yang of depression.
Right. And when you do these book tours or meet and greets or things like that, and fans come up to you, you probably have a certain percentage that say, you're an inspiration, you're a role model, and you've helped me, you know, get on the right track. And then you have those that probably say, how dare you? I mean, what do you have to be depressed about? You're handsome, you're successful, you're famous, you're...
Well, in the autobiography, I explain what all that means, is that I sought fame and fortune because I thought it would heal me. And it, you know, it's the same reason people do drugs, the same reason people too much drinking. And, you know, I mean, we're looking for healing.
Right.
You know, is it the base, bottom rung of all that stuff? Mm-hmm. And I was looking for healing, too, with fame and fortune. When it started, I thought I was right. I thought, yeah, this is working. But, you know, a couple of years into it, you start to realize that nothing's really changed within you.
Mm-hmm.
And I said in my autobiography that it was the big lie of fame to me, was that it isn't healing. It there's no restorative power in it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that the change has to always come from within. And it doesn't matter if you think someone's great looking look at all the beautiful movie stars that were, you know, got into drugs and alcohol and incredibly depressed people. It really has nothing to do with how others view you. It's how you view your environment. Mm-hmm. Purely comes from within you.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of young ladies around the world who have had your poster in their rooms, and
the depressing poster child. You mean?
No, I mean the very handsome, good-looking Rick Springfield posters, and have collected your music over the years and followed your career. And I know that one of the reasons that you have been known around the world is because of the big Grammy that you got in '81 and for the hit Jessie's Girl. So if I could touch on that for just a little mm-hmm. bit, and you had said somewhere if you weren't depressed, then and everything was going well, then there wouldn't have been a song, Jessie's Girl.
There wouldn't have been any songs. All my songs, you know, and people, because I had such an image initially as this kind of bright, shiny guy, you know, mm-hmm. pop guy, a lot of people initially missed the anger in Jessie's Girl. It's a very angry song, but then where that Jessie's Girl started to become take on a life of its own was when it was put in the film Boogie Nights. Sort of mm-hmm. The director understood the anger in that song right. and put it in a great moment in the scene of Boogie Nights, and so that was kind of the start of Jesse's Girl's other career after it left me.
Mm. Can you do a little of it?
That's it. Pretty.
That's
much.
It.
Oh, no. Let me tune up.
Well, everybody would know that right away. I mean, and to name that tune, you play that just that much, people would say, Jesse's Girl, Rick Springfield.
Name that tune. Jesse is a friend. Yeah, no, he's been a good friend of mine. But lately something's changed. It ain't hard to define. Jesse's got himself a girl and I want to make her mine. And she knew what tune we're going to have. Play along with the charade. There doesn't seem to be a reason to change. You know, I feel so dirty when they start talking cute. I want to tell her that I love her, but the point is probably moot. Cause she's watching with those eyes. And she's loving with that body out this morning. And he's holding her in his arms late at night.
Standing around the world right now for Rick Springfield. So, I mean, that song must have validated it all for you. I mean, number one and Grammy, and you must have just said, hey, you know, I got
I'm cool
some,
now.
Yeah, I'm cool epic. Now. I'm here. I've arrived.
Yeah, it was great. I mean, it was certainly a dream come true. I'd always wanted to have my music be successful.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it's certainly, you know, like I said, it's taken on a life of its own. So. Mm-hmm.
And Mom must have been pretty proud, too.
She
probably
had
a lot to say.
Unlike the book.
That's right.
There's no rude part. Well, there is kind of rude parts in the song, too. But yeah, she saw me. Actually, my mom has been a big champ. My dad died early when just as that song was first going up the charts. So it was mm-hmm. really a tough, kind of a brutal but awesome time for me at the same time.
Wow.
But mom saw me play, like, did three nights at Carnegie Hall in New mm-hmm. York, and that was a big deal to her, you know. So she came to that and thought it was a bit loud, that's all.
And the original recording was, you had Neil Giraldo in the song.
Neil Giraldo played the guitar on the original guitar on the original track of Jesse's Girl.
And that's, you know, what, we're talking 35 years now, and you're getting back together with Neil, I understand.
Yeah, we're going on tour, and about time, you know, 30 years.
That's right, a long wait
for
a reunion.
Yeah.
But he's going to be on tour. You're going to join Pat Benatar, mm-hmm. and Neil is her husband, so, the you know, just the three of you guys are on the road?
No, well, their band and my band, you know. Mm-hmm. I just saw talked to Neil the other day, actually, and we're all excited about it because it's a good bill.
Yeah. Oh, it's going to be a lot of fun, I'm sure. Yeah, and, you know, you've been doing an acoustic or a laid-back acoustic tour. How's that been for you? That's got to feel different.
Totally. It's very different from our electric band show, because electric band show is really loud and mm-hmm. and a lot of high energy. With the solo show is just it's storyteller kind of stuff, and mm-hmm. just sit back and tell a lot of stupid, funny stories.
A lot of people don't know that you're a funny guy, but you really are. You're
yeah, you have to. Got to have a sense of humor.
Right, right, to survive these days.
Yeah.
So you've played in festivals with 80,000 people, you know, 100,000 people, and you've played, you know, 300, 500.
Audience of one.
What, you know, do you have a preference? Does, I know they're a totally different thing, but, you know.
It's as long as it's... I get my energy on stage from the audience, and, mm-hmm. and really that happens if there's 35 or 35,000. It's really the same kind of feeling.
Too. Mm-hmm. Now, when you scored, you know, the number one hit with Jesse's Girl, was that something you knew right away? You said, "I've got a hit here," or was it a surprise to you?
No, I didn't actually think it was a single when I wrote it. I thought there were much better songs on the album.
Right, right, right. And of course, you had some big hits too on that album as well, several mm-hmm. albums worth. But, you know, now you're on tour, you're doing the hits. How have your fans changed over the years? You still get, you know, are they followed you? Are you? When you're on stage, you must be performing for the ones who grew up with you in the 80s.
Yeah.
And some teenagers who are fond of you now for the first time.
Yeah, it's a good mix. It's a lot of the people from, you know, that grew up with me.
Mm-hmm.
Some bring their kids, as other people have found me through different avenues. And so the solo show brings out, more couples come to that. There's
right.
actually more guys come to that show than...
Really?
So, yeah. And because a lot of guitar playing and...
Right, right.
And not just you. But, yeah.
So are you doing a world tour? Is this just a U.S. tour?
The thing with Pat is just U.S. at the moment. But mm-hmm. I'm going to Australia with my band in October for the first time. Actually, being an Australian, I've never toured Australia as a solo artist, which is kind of weird.
Whoa.
Did a lot in bands, mm-hmm. toured all over the country.
Is there additional pressure there going to work?
Going there? No, yeah. No, not at all. I'm really excited about it, actually. Mm-hmm. Yeah, very excited.
And bringing the family?
Yeah, because my mom's still there. She's still kicking.
Still good. Well, that's great. I mean, she's reading your books. We need her, you know, to give the reviews. She's got to tell you if it's good or not. So, Magnificent Vibration is the follow-up to a big autobiography. What's next for you? I mean, I know this just came out, so it's kind of early to talk about the next book, but somebody like you who's always creative, always thinking, always coming up with ideas, you know, is there anything in your mind that you're
thinking? Well, I'm working on a sequel to that now.
Oh, are you?
Yeah.
Oh.
Because it ends at a very...
You leave us hanging.
Very much a hanging point, but... Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to know where it went. So
right, right, right.
I had to write it and find out where it went.
Any chance of this getting picked up for a film? I mean, is this the kind of
thing? I think we think it's a very cinematic book, but mm-hmm. it's extreme, and it's certainly, it would be an expensive movie to make, but it depends. You know, mm-hmm. maybe when the sequel's done, they'll think, you know.
That's right.
Yeah, because it goes more extreme places.
And how about an album? I mean, you know, it's been a few years now, 2-3 years since the last album. So. Which was 17, album 17, right? I mean,
is it?
Wow. Something like that. Yeah, there's a lot there. There's a pile.
Wow. yeah, I'm working on stuff now and talking to the guy. I actually have written the last two albums with somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about just ideas, throwing some ideas around now. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I got to get in the mode. At the moment, I'm in the prose mode, but I got to get in the song mode. It's a very similar thing, but it's just a commitment.
Right, right, right. The first song you played was a bluesy song.
Yeah.
And, you know, you do the rock, you do the pop stuff. Is there anything, a genre that you haven't done that you want to do? Country, you want to try that? Or...
Well, there is a country song I wrote, but I can't sing it because there's some swearing in it.
Uh-oh, can't do that. Rick Springfield. Now, if people want to get the new book, obviously it's available in bookstores, but let's say they live around the world and they're listening or watching right now and they want to get it. Will it be available online at different book?
Oh, yeah. It's online on all the online sites.
Amazon, I guess, sells
What's
books.
That?
Amazon
yep.
and all the places. How about your website? Is there a website people go to?
RickSpringfield.com. Yeah, you got all the info there. Yeah.
And the tour info's there, too. So if they want to reach out, are you active on Facebook and stuff, people?
Yeah, I got a Facebook and... all that stuff, you know, tweet.
Well, that's great.
Twitter.
Well, you know, what a pleasure to talk to you and to meet the guy behind the legend because, you know, I've listened to your music and loved your music for many years. And, of course, we've seen you in films. You know, you did the Dave Grohl thing and with the Foo Fighters and you did your own documentary, which was about you. And so you've been on the big screen. You've been on the small screen. You've been everywhere. You do so many things so well. Now, you know, as far as your children go, Are you encouraging them to get into the business? Are you saying don't get into the business?
No. If they want to, you know, they're both of them are in the business. Mm-hmm. My eldest son's a writer and actor and a singer, great singer, great guitar player. Mm-hmm. My youngest son's doing production stuff now in the production house. So they're all, you know, they're all real interested in it, and it's always been around. So
right.
I wouldn't discourage anyone from, you know, I think people only discourage people, their kids from work they're in because they know the pitfalls and the dangers and everything, but you don't know the dangers and the pitfalls of, say, being a banker or being a car salesman either, you know?
Right.
You only
right.
know the dangers of your career, so
right,
maybe
right.
you can help them.
Now, if you could dig deep and remember, what was the best advice you ever got and who gave it to you? Because there's a lot of people who are struggling with various issues and also trying to make it in showbiz and are listening and watching right now that are saying, what can I learn from a legend?
Well, the most important thing that I think is kind of what I've always tried to do my best, but the three things I tell my kids, the most important things in the world, are never give up, never give up, never give up.
Wow, great advice. Well, I appreciate your time. I know you're very busy. You're here in D.C. for the Correspondents' Dinner at the White House, which is a big honor. So, you know, I'm sure it'll be a lot of fun for you there.
Yeah,
maybe you get to perform. I don't know if you're going to perform.
No, well, I think we're just eating.
Just eating.
We do that pretty well, though.
And on tour with Pat Benatar and Neil Giraldo starting in June sometime. And, of course, you're on your own tour as well. The new book is now out as of this week, Magnificent Vibration from Rick Springfield. So get a copy of that. Thank you, Rick, for coming on the show.
My pleasure.
This is Border Crossings on The Voice of America. I'm Larry London. This is Larry London. It's the voice of America's border crossings. And with me today on the show, we have a music icon, a man who's responsible for not one but several bands. He's a voice that I'm sure you've heard over the years. Paul Rogers is on the telephone with me. And we welcome you to Border Crossings and to the world. We're broadcasting to 60 countries, and I'd like to first of all start off by saying congratulations on the success of the brand new CD, The Royal Sessions. It's number one on the blues chart.
Well, thanks, Larry. It was a joy and a pleasure to make this album.
Why does this album stand out among your collection to you? I mean, this is a very special album. Maybe you can elaborate on what made you decide to do something like this.
Well, what made me decide to do this was the opportunity came up when my producer, Perry Margoloff, was down in Memphis, and he called me from the Royal Studios and said, this place is here. It's wonderful. It's still got the atmosphere from the early days. The musicians are incredible. Do you fancy coming down? Would you like to come down and record a couple of tracks and see how it feels? So I went down there, and we spent 3 days recording with the Reverend Charles Hodges and the high rhythm section and all the guys. And we just had I had a wonderful time, you know. And we understood each other. I mean, I love this music, and these guys are the masters of it. They pretty much invented it, you know. And it was like coming home for me. It's a long way from Middlesbrough, my hometown,
right,
Memphis, but I was so glad to be there.
And the Stax sound, the Memphis Soul Stax sound, is very, very unique, and it's very recognizable. So for you to come from groups, you know, that you've come from, like Bad Company and Free, which are heavy guitar, heavy rock sounds, and then all of a sudden incorporate the Memphis horn section, how did that feel to you? Was that kind of an adjustment, or was that something you've always done, or how did it feel?
I think it's something I've always done in my mind, you know. Mm-hmm. I can hear the brass sections. I never really put them in anything that we did, you know, in a rock way, if you like. But when I was listening when I was 14 and 15, I used to love that brass section. I've been down so long, you know.
Right.
And I always thought one day I would love to have the full-on band with the brass section and the beautiful singers and sometimes even the strings. And we finally did that, and it was really a great experience. And we recorded everything analogs, and we were live in the studio. So a lot of the tracks went down with one take, and then we worked on them from there.
The first song, I Thank You, one of my favorites, all-time favorites. Now, you covered a couple of Otis Redding songs, and you did an Al Green song. You did a whole bunch of different kinds of soul famous music from Memphis. Now, how did you pick the 10 you came up with? Because that's got to be a monumental chore to figure out 10 out of all the hundreds and hundreds there are.
Yeah, you know, none of it was really a chore, though, Larry. It was so nice to do. I had this choice. I could do anything I wanted, and the guys were wide open to whatever I wanted to do, which was wonderful. And I had a selection really in my own mind of about 30 or 40 songs that I could have called up on. And I would go in the studio each day and say, okay, what's the mood today? You know, are we up? Are we kind of mellow? And I would just call a song, and we would play it. And every single time, all of the tracks we did were master tracks, you know. There was one incident, there was one moment when I was walking between the studio and the control room, and I saw a 24-track master, and on the side was written Ann Peebles, I Can't Stand the Rain. And I sort of stopped, and everybody piled up behind me. And I said, is that the master for this track? And they said, yeah. She recorded that here, and we were the band that played on it.
Wow. That's fantastic.
I said, what, can we do that track? And they said, yep, we can. And we went and played that. And the other thing, interestingly, talk about authenticity, we managed to find the original electric bongos that were played on that track, and we used them on the track as well.
Wow.
So, we got it. I think we aimed to get it right. I aimed to try to get the feel the way I felt it when I was listening to it as a kid. It moved me so much. I wanted to do it justice.
Right.
And I hope that we did.
I can't stand the rain against my window, bringing back sweet memories. Hey, window pane, do you remember how sweet it used to be? There's just one sound that I just can't stand. I can't stand the rest against my window, bringing back sweet memories. I can't stand the rain against my window, 'cause she's not here with me. Alone with my pillow, where her head used to lay. I know you got sweet memories, but like the window, you ain't got nothing to say. I can't stand the rain against my window, bringing back sweet memories. I can't stand the rain against my window. It just keeps on haunting me.
A different feeling when you do an album of music that you want to do versus an album that's driven by the record company and by the business side of things. And listening to this album, it was a pleasure to listen to.
Yes, absolutely. You make a very good point. You know, because I've always tried to aim for that. With Bad Company, one of the great things about Peter Grant as a manager was that he took all the business away from us, and all we had to do was go in the studio and make the music. And in many respects, this album was like that. We actually went in and we just did what we wanted to do and nothing else. There was no pressure. Oh, you'll need a single and you'll need this and you got to do this and we don't like that track. None of that. We just did, you know, what we wanted to do. And Perry Margoloff, my producer, suggested we did my first song that I ever wrote, which was called Walk in My Shadow. And I said, do you think it'll work with this style of music? And he said, give it a shot, let's see. And man, it really worked. They put some brass on it, and Lanny played the set, you know, wailed on it, and it was just awesome.
Well, the whole thing is great from start to finish, and it's quite a collection of wonderful songs from a great archive, a great collection, a library. Now, you've donated the proceeds to the Memphis Stax Music Academy. Why did you decide to give the money away on the sales of the record, and why did you choose this charity?
Well, that's a great question, because that's another thing that that we found we could do, because Perry and myself were financing this whole thing because we wanted to have complete control over it, and then we went to the record company. Here's the record. Do you like it? Do you want to release it? You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But we could also say, and we did this, we discussed it on the way to the studio, how much this music has given to us. Wouldn't it be nice to give something back? And we said, we thought for a second, and we went, yeah, well, why don't we give all the proceeds back to Memphis? And, you know, that's what we're going to do.
That's wonderful. Well, God bless you, Paul. That's fantastic. Now, here's something else. I know in the United States there's a big push about music education, music in schools for kids, and a lot of times that program is subject to cut. How about in the UK, in London, where you're from and where you reside? Is music in schools an issue? Is it prominent? Is it making headlines?
Yeah. Well, you know what? I think it's the first thing to go. I mean, whoever it is that decides these things, decides that other academic fields are more important. But it has been proven, actually, that where there is music in the schools, the academic level rises. There's something about music that does something to your mind that increases intelligence, I guess, you know. Mm-hmm. And I know from my own experience when I was growing up, when I was about 13 and 14, it certainly kept me off the streets and gave me a focus and a community to be involved with, you know, the community of a band, mm-hmm. your mates, really. And that's definitely a positive thing, you know. Yeah, we should not lose sight of that.
We're talking to Paul Rogers, who's on the line with us in, where are you right now? Where are we speaking to?
I'm in Toronto.
Toronto, Canada.
Yeah.
That's wonderful. You have a home there, don't you, I think? Somewhere
well,
in Canada?
I do, and I have a wonderful wife here, too.
Well, that's lucky you.
Yeah.
Now, I'll tell you what, Rolling Stone magazine put you in their 100 greatest artists of all time list, and I know you've been referred to by your fans as The Voice. So the question is, where does Paul Rogers get his inspiration?
Well, you know, actually, my inspiration really comes from the material we've just been talking about. Otis Redding is probably my most favorite singer, I think. There's something about his delivery, tone of voice, and just the attitude of really a lot of love in his voice. And it really inspired me when I was a kid, and it still inspires me now to this day. And so many great singers that some have passed away, some are still kicking it out there. You know, Little Richard, John Lee Hooker, Albert King, just so many. Those were my teachers, and they still inspire me. I can still listen to that music and get goose pimples, you know.
Now, you have been in so many, legendary bands. There's so much to Paul Rogers, and I know Bad Company, of course, and Free, and there's a bunch of others, and you've had some other side projects as well. Now, Queen, you decided you wanted to see Queen back on the road, so you contacted Brian May, I guess. Is that how the story goes? And you said, let's put this band back together?
Well, they contacted me, actually, and to be honest with you, if we hadn't played together, I would have been very doubtful about doing that. But we had played together in a TV station, on a TV show. It was an award show, actually, and for Chris Blackwell, and they wanted me to close the show with All Right Now. And Brian said to me, hey man, we'll be your backing band for All Right Now if you'll be our singer for We Will Rock You. I went, oh, okay, we'll try that, you know.
Fair trade.
We tried it, and it was just such a wonderful thing. You know, we were so connected. We decided we'd do more. I hadn't actually planned to stay as long as 4 years. But ultimately, we toured the world twice, and we did some amazing shows. The fans were fantastic. And I was glad to help resurrect them, and they're up and running now. So we had a great time with it.
Yeah, why do you work so hard? I mean, you've established so much and accomplished so much. You know, you're still going. Is it the love of the music, the love of the crowd? What is it that keeps Paul Rogers going?
Well, thanks, Larry. You know, I've come to the point now, actually, where I do about 20 or 30 shows a year, and that's how I keep focused on on the music, and I keep doing different things. Different challenges. You know, Queen was a challenge. This in its way, doing the Royal Sessions, was another challenge because I felt I had to really do justice to these songs. But it was also a total pleasure.
Yeah, well, the album is fantastic. Where can people get this? Online around the world? Can they go to Amazon and iTunes?
Yes, all of the above. They can also check out my website and Facebook, Paul Rogers Official, and the album's available there. Our information about it is there, and everything that we're doing.
And you mentioned that you do a limited number of shows. Any plans for a world tour?
Not just yet.
Sounds like it's on the QT. Something's going on. Tight lip, not going to tell too much.
Well, the thing is, I am touring solo this year in in North America here, and I'm also touring with Bad Company, and I will also be doing two shows with the Memphis guys from the session, and we'll be filming that so that we will have a DVD available.
Excellent. That's outstanding. Paul Rodgers is on with us, and it's The Royal Sessions, the name of the new CD. What are your favorite songs? Give me a couple of I know they're all your favorites, but if you had to pick one or two that are can't-miss, must-listen-to songs on the album, what would they be?
Well, I loved singing Walk On By. That was when I first heard that, I heard the Isaac Hayes version. Well, I actually heard the earlier version, Dionne Warwick, obviously before then. But when I heard Isaac Hayes' version, I just about fell on the floor. It was such a beautiful version. And I always wanted to be good enough to play, to be able to sing that song and get away with it. And hopefully I've achieved that here, because, you know, it was such a great, beautiful track that they put down for me.
See me walking down the street and I start to cry each time we meet. Walk on by, walk on by, make believe, make believe. You don't see the tears, just let me grieve in private, 'cause each time I see you, I can't help myself, I go to pieces, I break down and cry. Get over losing you, and so if I seem broken in two, please walk on by, walk on by, foolish pride, oh my foolish pride. Sadness you gave me, you put the hurt on me, you socked it to me, mama, when you said goodbye. Please walk on by. I miss you so much, baby. The way you used to talk with me. I miss you so much, baby. And the way you used to walk. Down the street and I start to cry each time we meet. Why don't you walk on by? Walk on by. Make believe that you don't see the tears. Just let me grieve in private, 'cause each time I see you, I can't help myself. I go to pieces, baby. Oh, oh, I break down and cry. Baby, I don't want you to see me break down and cry. Don't stop. Don't even turn around. Don't stop, baby. You go your way. I know I've got to go mine somehow. It's not the smoke that's making me cry. There's no dust in my eyes. No, no, baby, it's the hurt you. Yes, it's the hurt I'm feeling deep down inside. Walking down the street, and I start to cry.
Last question, and then I'm going to let you go. Battle of the Bands, Free versus Bad Company, who wins?
Oh, that's a tough one, Larry. That's a tough one. I don't think I can answer that because I love them both. You know, we you know, Free was very special to me because they had Paul Kossoff,
right?
And we he and I formed that band together back in the days. And we were, you know, just kids, really. It was so great for us to have a taste of success together. I miss Paul, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, Bad Company was explosive and big and beautiful in its way, because when we first started out, we were number 99 in the charts at the beginning of the tour. And at the end of the tour, we were number one. So it was a real magic carpet ride and with a lot of fond memories. And we're still out there rocking, so it's... it's all good.
That's right. You're going on the road with Leonard Skinner very soon, too, so.
Yes, we are.
That'll be a great show.
Our rock brothers.
Your rock brothers. Well, thank you, Paul Rogers, for talking with us. The new album is The Royal Sessions, and continued success. When you're in D.C., come on into the studio. We'd love to have you here on The Voice of America.
I'd love to be there. Thanks, Larry.
Thank you, Paul Rogers. My name is Larry London. Thanks to the whole crew for putting together today's program. This is Border Crossings on the VOA Music Mix Network.
Larry's on Twitter. Follow him at BCVOA.